Good morning. On September 11, 2001, I was assigned to the National Guard Bureau in Washington, D.C. as the executive officer for the director of the Air National Guard. I was called by the Operations Center at about 8:50 that morning with news that an aircraft had flown into the World Trade Center in New York City. As an experienced aviator, I assumed that a small plane had been involved and quite likely some very bad weather or perhaps pilot had a heart attack. I directed the ops center to confirm details. They reported clear weather and unconfirmed eyewitness accounts that the aircraft had been an airliner. That simply made no sense. CNN was covering the breaking story and the video showed thick billowing smoke pouring out of the North Tower. My commander, a Major General, arrived in his office and I briefed him on the situation. As I finished, we turned to watch the news broadcast, and in that instant, the South Tower was struck by another airliner. We knew we were under attack. We responded as you would expect. My boss issued a series of orders, and I executed those actions. The Air National Guard Crisis Action Team was ordered to stand up. The Operations Center confirmed communication with the field and with Pentagon leadership. At around 9:35, as these initial steps were being taken, we felt a violent explosion. It shook our building. We had no idea what had happened or what the explosion was. A few minutes later, we received confirmed reports that another airliner had flown into the Pentagon. The third terrorist attack that day with an airliner. Minutes later, we received reports of another airliner heading for Washington, D.C. This triggered many buildings in Washington to order evacuation, including ours. The order was given to evacuate our headquarters. I am not aware of a single man or woman in uniform who obeyed that order. The aircraft never made it to D.C. The passengers were incredibly brave, and they overpowered the terrorist, and the aircraft crashed in Pennsylvania. The actual target was never confirmed. And for the next several hours, the fog of war was evident. There were persistent reports of additional terrorist attacks in Washington, D.C., accounts of explosions on the Mall, the Smithsonian, the White House, and the Capitol. But none of these reports were true. And as the first responders performed magnificently in New York, Washington, and Pennsylvania, we in the military did our job at home and abroad. A process was begun to increase our readiness. We recalled personnel, we placed aircraft and units on alert, and we began to fly airborne patrols over key locations in our nation. It's important to note, as these events unfolded, all of us who did our job that day had personal concerns that weighed on us heavily. For me, it was my wife, Colleen, who also worked in Washington, D.C. We spoke briefly after the towers were struck, but we couldn't reconnect after the Pentagon attack because the circuits were overloaded. Now, with the persistent stories of additional terrorist attacks and my duties, which frequently had me in the Pentagon, we were both anxious about each other's safety. Colleen's office next to FBI headquarters had been evacuated after the Pentagon strike, and her boss offered to drive her and a coworker home. As soon as they left the parking lot, they were stuck in gridlocked traffic and sat for quite a long time. As they sat, a solitary airliner flew overhead, and she relayed to me later how she shuddered involuntarily and how this spurred her into action, and she decided she wasn't going to sit in that car anymore. So she started walking with her friend, and they decided they would take the subway. Now, the subway was working that day, but because of the fears of terrorist attacks, nobody was riding it. They were nervous when they boarded the subway. In fact, they were two of only four people on the train that day. But it operated without incident, and Colleen made it home at 4 p.m. She called to say she was safe. She told me not to worry. I was glad to get that call. Our work at the Guard Bureau continued, and after many long hours, a battle rhythm was established. We had a plan of action in place for the next 24 to 48 hours, and my boss departed for home to get ready for an early morning. I was not ready to go home. I was keyed up from the day's events, which seemed surreal to me. So I decided to go for a run. As I ran, I was drawn to the Pentagon. I ran through the deserted streets, sometimes redirected by police, but I worked my way to a hill that looks down on the Pentagon on the side of the attack. When I arrived, the scene was graphic, and it seared in my memory forever. The firefighters heroically fought the blaze as the Pentagon continued to burn. Flame licked the sky, and thick black smoke poured from inside. A small group of citizens had gathered. They held U.S. flags, and they sang patriotic songs. They prayed, and they sang Amazing Grace. Men and women openly wept, and some were clearly frightened. And as I watched, I realized how angry I felt. Angry at what I'd seen in New York when the towers were struck and later fell. Angry at watching our Pentagon burn. Angry that so many of my citizens had been killed that day. And angry that so many of our fellow citizens and our nation would be changed forever. I offered a prayer for the victims and the first responders lost that day and for their families, and I headed for home. It was late when I arrived home. My wife was still up watching the news. It was the same video and the same reports over and over again. It was clear she was upset. She'd been sobbing. I turned off the TV and I held my wife. For a while, we said nothing. Over time, we started to talk, and after a few hours, we felt better. And we made a few decisions that night, right then and there. We decided we would continue to live our life with confidence in our nation and in God. And I think that's not a trivial point because, like all Americans, we had to decide what we would do on a personal level. And the next day that answer came as our country returned to work. We drove our highways. We went to the market. We boarded the trains. We made a decision as a nation that we would not live in fear. Colleen and I also resolved that we had to visit New York. And so we did a few days later. We couldn't get to ground zero, but we got close. We talked with police, firefighters, and guardsmen involved in the early cleanup. We listened as family members openly grieved and realized that the fine powder that was everywhere likely contained not only steel and concrete, but the remains of people who worked in that building that day. There was nothing to say. We held hands and we walked north toward Midtown. As we walked, we crossed many streets. We passed many firehouses. And at each firehouse, they had pictures up of the firefighters lost in the response. They had walls of notes and cards from people all around the world expressing well wishes. And I remember Colleen and I laughed openly at a note from a six-year-old in California who wrote simply, "So, New York, how you doing?" We marveled at the firefighters and the police officers on duty despite the tragedy, adding context to the phrase, to serve and to protect. Those were intense days. It's been 10 years. We've all changed. We've all experienced many highs and lows. I've deployed for my nation, and I'm proud of my unit's contribution. I felt the pain of leaving family and the joy of returning. I've been privileged to command thousands of National Guardsmen, the vast majority of whom have deployed for combat operations, and many of them have deployed multiple times. They are simply the finest men and women I've ever met, and they've performed magnificently. But sadly, not all came home. And over 150 Wisconsin warriors paid the ultimate price for our freedom. Since holding this position, I've had the privilege of meeting most of these warriors' families. I have powerful memories of these families, and I'm humbled by their strength and grace. And because it's the 10th anniversary, I'd like to just share two stories generically because I think it highlights the connection with these families. The first involves visiting parents after news that their son had been killed in combat. The father told me about his son growing up and how he loved the military and how proud he was of his son. After we had expressed our condolences and were leaving, I embraced each parent, and as I held the mother, she pulled me close. She whispered in my ear that she was sorry for what I was going through. If you can imagine, a mother who had just lost her son expressing concern for me. I was stunned and overwhelmed by her compassion. And the second story is of presenting a flag at graveside, a poignant moment. And as I presented this flag on behalf of a grateful nation, the mother took the flag and held it close to her breast. And she closed her eyes, and one single tear rolled down her cheek. That tear etched a path on my soul. I tell you, there are not words adequate to tell these families how grateful we are and how sorry we are for what they've gone through. I've reflected on 911 many times since that day, and I believe the terrorists miscalculated grossly. They proved they could sucker punch us. But we've responded, and over the past 10 years, many evil men have been held to account. The miscalculation is that they do not understand what America is, who we are. They thought they could defeat us by knocking down a few buildings or burning our Pentagon. They did not understand that our strength is in our freedom, our Constitution, and our people. We are a resilient nation, and despite being counted out again and again throughout history, our nation always rises to the occasion. So today, on this 10th anniversary of 911, I will again say a prayer. A prayer for comrades lost, for brave first responders, and for men and women willing to put on a uniform, endure the rigor of hard training, and when called, answer that call and deploy into harm's way. A prayer for families who have lost so much. And a prayer of gratitude to Almighty God for the continuing blessings on this great country. This is a great country, and it's a privilege to serve her. Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, when our country faces crisis, we look to our leaders to guide us. And here in Wisconsin, we are blessed with a great leader today. And it's my privilege to introduce him at this point. The Commander-in-Chief of the Wisconsin National Guard, the 45th Governor of the great state of Wisconsin, Governor Scott Walker.